Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm John Ellich, and this is Skylines, the Citymetric podcast. As I record this, it's about lunchtime on Thursday, and it's local election day here in, well, not in the UK, in England, and not even all of England, in parts of England. It's a fairly sort of random assortment of councils that are up for election this year. I've not been looking at all of them because I am but one man. But there's a couple I've been paying quite close attention to. And, you know, this episode is not going to be primarily about local politics. We'll probably do a post-mortem next week once we have some results. But I thought, you know, the races I am looking at, I thought I'd give you a very quick rundown of. One is the Sheffield City Region Metro Mayor election. As if you're a long-time listener, you may recall that last year I got very, very excited about the arrival of six different Metro Mayors in different regions across the country. Sheffield really should have been in that batch, but there's been a bit of a row over the exact geography of that deal. Originally, it was going to be a rather bigger area, including parts of not only the old South Yorkshire, but also parts of Derbyshire and Nottinghamshire. Then those county councils realised this would cost them money, so they didn't really like that very much. Then the ongoing row about devolution in the rest of Yorkshire caused many of the councils in that county to get together and demand a single deal for Yorkshire. Those included, I believe, Barnsley and Doncaster, which are in South Yorkshire and in the Sheffield City region. But by that point, there was already a piece of legislation. So the government told them in not so many words to bugger off. The result of this is that the Sheffield City region is not widely loved. Two of the four councils in it don't really think much of it. The new mayor is not going to have many powers. It's also not a very competitive election, which is a very, very gentle way of putting the fact that it's not a remotely competitive election. It's going to be Labour's Dan Jarvis. Like, it's a very, very red area. To American listeners over here, red means left wing, not right wing. So yes, we already know who that's going to be, and that he doesn't really want to be mayor of the Sheffield City region, actually. He wants to be mayor of Yorkshire, so we'll be spending his time in the job campaigning to extend the geography to encompass the whole of the county of Yorkshire, which also includes a number of other cities such as Leeds, Bradford, Wakefield, Hull, and so on. So the only real thing to watch here is turnout. Simon Jeffrey, I believe, of the Centre for Cities was tweeting earlier that if it got above 15%, that would be quite impressive, which is depressing, but may well, in fact, be true. Because, I mean, why really would you go out to vote for someone who's definitely going to win in a foregone conclusion, a job he doesn't really want to represent an area that doesn't think it exists? So that's fun. The other thing I've been paying attention to is the London elections, where the 32 boroughs which make up Greater London are up for election this year. It should be a good year for the Labour Party down here. There's been lots of talk about how Labour is really going, like, the Tories are stuffed in London, basically, because Brexit is very unpopular here. The recent Windrush scandal, in which British citizens of several decades standing have been threatened with deportation or even actually deported because the Home Office burnt their paperwork, and Theresa May's hostile environment immigration policy is not a great look. All that's incredibly unpopular in London, where the Tories have been struggling for a while. So polls have got it about 50% Labour, about 30% Tories. So off the back of that, there's been lots of talk about how maybe Labour might start winning some boroughs they've never won before. They should in normal times win Barnet in the north of the capital, which is, they've never held it before, but it's recently become quite a tight marginal. The thing that might hold them back there is that borough has a pretty large Jewish population, the largest proportionally in the whole of the UK, and the inability of Jeremy Corbyn to really get a handle on the Jewish community's discomfort around some of the things he says, and fears that some of the people he surrounds himself with might be anti-Semitic. That is the one place where it might actually hold the party back. So it's possible they won't win Barnet for that reason. Hillingdon in the west of the capital has tended to be a swing borough, as in it kind of swings to the opposition party shortly before it wins a general election. So that's one to watch. I'm hearing from on the ground over there that it's not looking good for Labour. But, you know, Labour canvassers always think it's not looking good for them, and other parties' canvassers tend to think it is looking good for them. So it's difficult to know how much to make of that until the results come in. The two that I think really, the speculation really has got out of control are Wandsworth, which has been a flagship Conservative borough for 40 years now, and Westminster in the west of central London, which the Tory party has always held and which Labour has never even got close to winning. I think it's very, very silly that the Labour Party allowed speculation to continue about the possibility to win either, let alone both of those. I think it's extraordinarily unlikely. So even if the party makes serious advances in the capital, as it should do, some of the coverage may say it was a disappointment. But, you know, we shall see. We'll know next week. We'll probably talk about that. I'll probably drag some of my political colleagues back into the podcasting dungeon to talk about those things. But as I say, this is not actually a local elections episode, despite the fact I've been banging on about them for several minutes now. What we're actually going to talk about this week is the Thames Estuary. And to do that, we've got a guest I really should have invited here quite a while ago, to be honest.
Hi, I'm Caroline Crampton. I'm the head of podcasts at The New Statesman, and I'm also currently working on my first book, which is a non-fiction work about the Thames Estuary.
So I feel like before we get into the Thames Estuary, like, it's taken me a long time to get you to do this podcast, considering you are basically in charge of podcasts around here, and you kind of prodded me to do it in the first place. So I should apologise if that has taken me more than 2 years to ask you.
That's okay.
Also, you produce all the other New Statesman podcasts, but you don't produce this one, and that's why my one sounds a bit rubbish.
That's not true. Yours sounds lovely.
That sadly really is true. But anyway, so yes, you're writing a book about the Thames Estuary. Why did you choose that subject?
Well, to be incredibly cliched about it, I didn't so much choose it as it chose me, in the sense that partly the book is about my family's immigration journey to the UK from South Africa. And my parents, who, let's just put this out there, are slightly eccentric people, decided in their sort of mid-20s that, you know, South Africa in the 70s and 80s was not really a place they wanted to be anymore. So they built a boat over 3 years in their evenings and weekends. And then when it was ready, they set off from Cape Town and they sailed all the way up the Atlantic, up the English Channel. And eventually, well, they decided that they were going to stay here. And they also decided that they didn't have enough money to, you know, live on the land, and therefore they needed to live on their boat for a while. And they reasoned that the place they were least likely to freeze to death in the winter was probably London. So they sailed all the way up the Thames Estuary and lived on the boat in London for a few months. And then when they finally managed to get jobs, it just so happened my dad, who's an engineer, he got a job at the steelworks on the Isle of Sheppey, which is one of the many glorious islands in the Thames Estuary. So they moved back out there on the boat initially, and then in a house. So it's where I was born, where I grew up. So that's kind of how I ended up writing about it, because it's really the place I know about the most.
That's an incredible story, which, despite having known you for a number of years, I had no idea about. Like, your parents, like, literally built a boat to come here. They didn't just get on a plane.
Yeah.
It's effectively, they built a house and then sailed it across an ocean to...
Yes, they did. My sister and I both have trouble processing people's amazement at this, if you know what I mean, because it's just been so much part of our lives and upbringings that we're like, yeah, well, obviously, didn't your parents come here on a boat they built? So, you know, we try very hard to see it objectively. But like, for instance, in my parents' house, they have these photographs that run all the way down the stairs that are of their journey to Britain, as it were. And in the first one, it's like the fiberglass pieces of the boat being delivered. And then the last one is this really wonky picture of Tower Bridge that my mum took when they came up the river for the first time. And it's really wonky because she's standing on the deck and the water's a bit choppy. But that's kind of the journey that they made.
That's amazing. I sort of want to keep talking about this, but we should probably get on to the actual the actual estuary. We'll do this bit another time. But okay, so there is a difference between a river and an estuary, and there's a difference between an estuary and a sea. Is there a kind of like, I mean, whether sort of, you know, officially or in your mind, is there a sort of an actual sort of point you can sort of point to and sort of say one becomes the other? Like, what actually is the estuary?
So there are lots of different definitions that are slightly different, but I think they generally agreed to be the sort of transition zone between a river and the sea. So still enclosed, but the banks widening. Often, you know, in some places, estuary kind of merges with delta, you know, in that, like the Nile Delta, it gets very flat and the water gets very slow moving and spreads out over a really wide area. But in the case of the Thames, it doesn't do that. It just really widens out. But then also there's some stuff to do with where the kind of tidal stream meets the river's stream. Although again, the Thames is a little bit of an exception in this because the tide in London goes all the way up to Teddington, where people, I think we'd all agree that the river itself carries on much beyond Teddington. So I think people differ in this, but I think in the Thames, basically once you're past about Greenwich, Thames Barrier area, you're basically in the estuary, and then it carries all the way on. And where it ends, this is something I'm currently grappling with in the writing of the book, because it's called The Way to the Sea. So I'm supposed to be like ending where the sea starts, but nobody really agrees where that is.
There is definitely a difference in character as you kind of move east up the Thames, though. I mean, like, if you kind of look at any of the sort of suburbs of West London on the Thames, like, the Thames tends to be quite picturesque. It's a place with, like, you know, pubs and restaurants a lot of it, where people, you know, people want to be close to it. At some point, it shifts to being this just kind of, like, impenetrable grey barrier in the landscape. It's kind of a hole in the map, almost. It's like there is no way. You can't really cross the Thames very easily east of about the Isle of Dogs. So it's just kind of like the world ends at the Thames. And that does kind of coincide with this sort of change of character you described, doesn't it?
So, yes, the Thames estuary is very low-lying and muddy and silty, and the tidal range is massive. So without the kind of investment that's been put into further upriver stretches of the Thames, where it's been kind of embanked and drained and sea walls built and all that kind of thing, the estuary's land is not that useful. You can't really farm it that well. It's not very safe to build on it. It floods a lot, all that kind of stuff. So from about the 19th century onwards, because it was this, as you say, this kind of grey hole in the landscape, 19th century London started to outsource its unpleasant problems to it. So it was a really good place to build unsightly structures that you didn't want any nearer to the city, but that you did need to have, like power stations, sewage works, cement works, docks, that kind of thing, that would, as you say, be hugely out of place in Hammersmith or Putney or something. But somehow it's fine to have them at Gravesend or Cliff or somewhere like that. So, yeah, it is not that accessible as a place to get to know. And I suppose that's why it's a bit unusual that I do feel such a connection to it and know it so well. But that's just because my family was always kind of waterborne, as it were.
I mean, what do you think the role that the estuary has played in the life of the city has changed over time with the sort of redevelopment of Docklands and kind of the decline of that heavy industry and so on?
It's definitely changed, but it's also, this outsourcing process has continued, because one of the really unique things about London, actually, is unlike a lot of other historic port cities, London is still a major port, and the geography of the estuary is what's enabled that. So, yeah, while the inner London docks have completely, they, you know, they were closing in the 60s and 70s and 80s and now have been turned into flats and City Airport and the Excel Centre and all that kind of thing. Just in, I think it was in 2011 or 12, the Port of London Authority opened a new container terminal in the Thames Estuary called London Gateway. And it's, you know, it's one of the biggest in Europe and it continues to bring in loads of money and it's still the Port of London. It's what it's still called. So docks, for instance, is a good example where they've just kind of hopped down the river as the demands for bigger ships and better cranes and all that has grown over the centuries. It went from, you know, ships used to tie up right by the customs house, mansion house area, right down to the Isle of Dogs, then out beyond that to Tilbury and now London Gateway. So it's just moved down river.
So where is London Gateway, sorry? Is that Tilbury or is that even further out?
No, that's much, much further, completely separate to Tilbury. So it's, do you know where the Hoo Peninsula is? So if you're thinking of the Kent side, you get Gravesend and then the land kind of curves up slightly and that's called the Hoo Peninsula and the very end of that is called the Isle of Grain. And on the Essex side, you get this sort of long, silty area after Thurrock and Grays and Tilbury before you get to Southend much further out, and London Gateway is on reclaimed land sort of in between Grays and Southend.
So Stamford La Hope, I think, is there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you grew up in Kent, I grew up in Essex, so I kind of have, I see the same geography from the opposite side. I mean, what I find interesting about that is we do have this whole stretch between about the Thames Barrier and the Tilbury London Gateway, which sort of doesn't really fit into either version of the modern estuary. You know, it's not sort of the functioning industrial bit we still have further out, but it's not undergone that redevelopment of kind of like, you know, Docklands and so on. I mean, do you have any sense of what the future is for that whole stretch?
I think it's very, very gradually starting to be repurposed for sort of new cleaner industry or for recreation. There are places where I remember when I was a child and we used to sail to London for half term and stuff like that, because obviously the best way of getting to a museum is to go on a boat. This further example of my parents' idiosyncratic ways. You know, I remember there being landfill sites and stuff which are now nice parks that you can see from the river and that kind of thing. You know, so there is a sort of a movement in that direction, but it's really slow. And to be honest though, a lot of things are just still there falling to bits. For the book last year, I did another journey down the river with my parents. They came and met me on the boat in London and we sailed out to sea from there. And whilst I was really, really surprised in some ways about how much things have changed, for instance, how much cleaner the river is than when I was doing the same journey 10 years ago, like I saw seals in the water, something I've never seen before. But also just all these massive sheds and factories and like old cement works and stuff, which you can see maybe a tiny corner of them is still operating, but most of them are just derelict. And this is something that you see in the estuary going back 100 years, is that because it's not a place that's like valued for what it looks like, it's not, quote, a landscape in that sense. When a power station ceases to be up-to-date functional technology, instead of it being demolished or, you know, turned into a fancy gallery, they just build another one next to it, which is not something I think you find much in Britain, actually, because we're quite a small island. We tend to prize our space and our views and our vistas, but not in the Thames Estuary, really.
Yeah, and there's something I remember, and you can still see it to a certain extent now, but something I certainly remember from being a kid in the 90s, is if you go to the bit of the Thames that runs past Newham, so just like the very eastern edge of Docklands, there were buildings that were literally falling down in the 90s that had been, I think they'd been bombed during Blitz, and were like, you know, buildings standing at an angle, and they'd just been abandoned because there was no kind of pressing need to sort of use that land for anything else. So they just kind of like, you know, blocked it off and moved on. And it's just really sort of kind of crazy to see that sort of industrial landscape in it in a busy city like London.
Yeah, well, I remember probably around the same time, sort of early to mid-90s, when I was a child and we would, as I say, sail up to London for weekends and stuff. My job would always be to stand on the deck with a boat hook and sort of repel chunks of stuff in the river that might hit the boat, because there were just jetties and buildings that were just constantly like dropping chunks of wood and God knows bits of masonry into the river. And in a fast tidal stream, it would sort of come at you quite fast and could make a hole in your boat if you weren't careful. So I would stand on the edge and like poke things that might hit us, which again was kind of normalized for me as a child. But when I think back on it, I'm like, that's crazy. Like, London is London, you know, this famous world global city. And yet there I was having to like repel bits of stuff that might make a hole in our boat.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I want to sort of talk about the sort of politics of the area around the estuary, because it's like, it's a bit UKIP-y, isn't it, as you go further out on both the Essex side and the Kent side. Like, Nigel Farage tried to get elected in Thanet, which is another of those sort of Kentish islands in the estuary, right? But, like, you do see the same sort of thing in Essex as well. I mean, why do you have any sense of how that happened?
Well, it actually started in the late 70s, early 80s. So the BNP's first elected councillor was in the Isle of Dogs, and it was during that period, you know, when the London Docklands Development Corporation, Thatcher's dream for how to privatise East London, was right at its beginning and really aggressively, you know, relaxing regulation and letting private companies just buy up land and build skyscrapers right next to where former dockers lived and that kind of thing. And there was this real problem on the Isle of Dogs, which is something that we've had again and again, where there were a lot of recent Bangladeshi immigrants and stuff living there. And the white working class population, a lot, you know, more than half of them had lost their jobs with no possibility of any future job after the docks closed, that kind of thing. There was this resentment that incoming families were getting council houses before people who lived there at the same time as luxury apartments were being built all over the place, that kind of stuff. And Labour had this really awful dog whistle election slogan that was like, homes for working people or something like that. And anyway, this early BNP guy took advantage of that, and he managed to win a council by-election in Millwall. He then lost like 8 months later when the actual election came around. But that was kind of, I feel like, the starting gun for a lot of this, because a lot of those things I've just mentioned, people will recall from even how we talk about Brexit these days, you know, former industrial areas, people who've lost jobs in industries that have just closed, they've got skills that just aren't relevant anymore. In this case, you had like aggressive Tory government trying to repurpose the land for banking and finance and stuff that those people were just not going to be able to participate in. And inevitably, this kind of nativist sentiment was on the rise. So I think that pattern is just then repeated as those people, you know, moved further east, as the Isle of Dogs gentrified and they couldn't afford to live there anymore. They end up in places like Barking and Dagenham. And then you see the, you know, the BNP problems that Margaret Hodge had in 2004-5. same thing again. And then I think UKIP, as the kind of inheritors of that nativist vote, it carries on. Like in the 2015 election, UKIP came extremely close to getting an MP there in Thurrock. And they still have lots of councillors. As you say, Medway Towns on the other side of the river, very UKIP-y. Thanet, extremely UKIP-y. Farage's seat of choice. So I think it is all just connected to this sense of being left behind, the sense that, you know, our industry's gone and the government's not doing anything to help us replace our jobs. And also the sense that because it's a port area traditionally, people are used to encountering lots and lots of different people of all different races and cultures. But as the port has declined, I think a kind of defensive attitude has developed. So like Thurrock, I think between the last two censuses, so 2001 and 2011, the BME population doubled from about 10% to about 20%, which I guess feels like quite a lot if you live somewhere quite small like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I know some of these places quite well because I grew up a bit further north away from the Thames, but I know Barking and I know Dagenham and Thurrock and so on. And it kind of, I think in a lot of ways, they feel like a sort of northern industrialised town that someone's plonked on the sort of eastern edge of London. Because, I mean, you look at Dagenham, where most people lived on the sort of Beckendry estate, which is the largest council estate in the world, I think. And most people worked at the sort of the huge Ford car plant there. And that plant's been sort of employing fewer and fewer people as the decades have gone on. So you do kind of have this sort of, you know, the sort of social and economic characteristics of a place like Barnsley. But half an hour up the district line from the city, it's kind of, yeah, it's just kind of a crazy combination, really.
It is. And I think, as well as I think all of the stuff that Barnsley's got going on, you then have the added friction when those two worlds kind of rub up against each other. And that's what you had in the Docklands in the 80s, you know, where you had bankers buying incredibly expensive apartments in former warehouse buildings and then also insisting that the developers put electronic gates everywhere because they were worried about the, you know, the former dockers coming and vandalising their cars. And, you know, so all of that just adds an element of like class resentment that I think is still quite live today.
So I mean, what's kind of what's the sort of most interesting thing that you found out in your research for this book, or the most shocking thing, perhaps?
So I think the most shocking thing, and I apologise in advance to any listeners who might be eating while I'm talking about this, is actually to do with sewage and how the Thames estuary played a part in what London did with sewage for a very long time. Because I didn't, having lived in London for nearly a decade at the point when I started writing this book, I did not know that when Joseph Bazalgette cleaned up the Thames after the great stink of London in the 1850s, you know, he built the great embankments with their intercepting sewers to take, rather, so instead of just pushing all the sewage into the river wherever people fancied, it was taken cleanly away east. What I didn't know was at that point was they were still just pumping it out into the river, just a bit further east, away from where people, you know, posh people lived who would care about it. So they were still, from the sewage works at Beckton, they were at high tide pumping all of the sewage in this really like pressurised, horrible, concentrated form out into the river and then letting the tide take it away out into the estuary. And this worked for a few years. And then in 1865, something which is now called the Princess Alice disaster took place, where about an hour after high tide, so just after all the sewage had been jetted out into the river and was starting to flow back down, a passenger ferry that was returning from a day trip to Margate hit a coal steamer in the centre channel in the Thames, right outside the Beckton sewage works. And the Princess Alice just like broke up and went under incredibly quickly. And nearly 600 people died. I think some estimates put it at 650, which I think is the worst shipping disaster ever in British waters. But what made it even worse, because you think, you know, if people fall in the Thames at that point, when it's not that wide, why couldn't they rescue them, you know? And the reason was because of the sewage. People just drowned in the sewage immediately.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's horrific. So I say I'm really sorry about people who are eating. But there are some, in some of the newspaper reports at the time, there are some horrific details about how, you know, they, undertakers were having to make coffins that were like three times larger than usual because bodies had swelled up because of all the noxious, horrible stuff in the river. And it was just absolutely awful. But anyway, that was the consequence of the so-called cleanup of the river, is that they just pushed it east to a place that no one really cared about. And so then after that happened, their solution, and this endured until the early 1990s, was that instead of pumping it out into the river, they just put it on boats and then took the boats even further out into the estuary and dropped it at sea, or at the point where the estuary kind of becomes the sea. And those were called Bovril boats. And yeah, as I say, they carried on using them up until the early 90s when EU regulations kicked in and said, no, you really just can't put all your sewage in the sea. That's not allowed. But yeah, that completely shocked me. When I put all that together, I was like, this is absurd. So this, you know, this great Victorian engineer who gets hailed as the saviour of London, he prevented all of these cholera outbreaks and all this kind of stuff. His solution was just to move the problem further downriver to a point where no one would really notice.
That, I mean, that has kind of been a consistent thing in the life of London. They're just, as you say, like shoving everything to the east. And you can kind of see it with even, you remember Boris Island?
Yeah.
When Boris Johnson wanted to like close Heathrow, redevelop it and build a new airport on an island in the Thames estuary. And even in that, you can kind of see this assumption that, you know, the people to the west of London are just kind of more important than the people to the east of London.
Yeah, it's amazing how that dichotomy still endures, but it definitely does. And I think it's still happening, but maybe in a slightly more positive sense now, in that, for instance, there are three massive wind farms in the Thames estuary now. One of them, the London Array, it's called, is I think the biggest in the world, or was until very recently the biggest in the world. And they generate a huge amount of energy. They're the massive offshore type, you know, with really huge turbines out on concrete plinths out at sea. And I think they're quite cool to look at. I think, and especially if you're, there's an exclusion zone around them, but if you're sailing, you can obviously go a lot closer than you can see them from the land. And they make this really cool noise. It sounds a bit like they're breathing. But obviously that's not something that people would be hugely happy to have further up the Thames, or say, you know, I know there's been a big fuss about the wind farm they're building off Brighton, you know, people complaining that it ruins the view and all of this. I don't think there was much complaint, or if it was, it wasn't given much heed about them building wind farms in the Thames estuary. You know, people on the Isle of Sheppey are just supposed to deal with that. So I suppose it's still happening that we're putting things that are necessary for London's future out in the estuary because we don't want to have to look at them higher up. But I'd rather they were wind farms than boats full of sewage.
Well, wind farms are better in most senses, I think. Although you can get energy from sewage, so maybe we shouldn't be quite so critical. So
yeah, you can. And so now that they're not allowed to use the Bovril boats anymore, they, you know, it's partly incinerated and partly converted into like agricultural product, that kind of stuff. So, you know, it is recycled now. But I do feel like as with a lot of these things, it's only necessity that forces the change. Nobody actually wants to avoid putting it in the estuary.
It is quite apt, though, because if you sort of think of like those sort of 18th century political cartoons which show like Great Britain as a person, I mean, that is anatomically correct.
Yes, I suppose so.
So that's something. Anyway, as we speak, you're what, 5 weeks away from your final manuscript? Is that the plan?
Don't remind me. Yes.
but like I appreciate it's probably not going to be out for a little bit when people can hear this podcast. But do you want to just sort of like say the sort of name and publisher and so on, so that people can put it on their Christmas list or whatever?
Okay, yeah, it won't even be out for Christmas, but you'll probably be able to pre-order it by then. So yes, it's going to be The Way to the Sea, published by Granter, I think in spring 2019, probably April or May. And yeah, if you follow me on Twitter or something, then you'll find out when you can actually buy it.
Cool, thank you very much.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.